Okay, why don't we go ahead and get started? Welcome to Signals and Systems. My name is Joe Piconi. You received an email from me last night pointing you to the class website and things like that. So if you have any questions about that, don't hesitate to ask. There are a few procedural things about the course. So the course is scheduled for Monday, Wednesday, Friday from 11 to 12. And then we also have a recitation section, which is will be led by graduate student Hal Ma, who's in the back there. Hal, say hello. And the recitation section will be, he'll arrange a time for that. Typically, we've done those on Tuesdays or Thursdays. They'll be in the evening, so it doesn't conflict with your other courses. And it's scheduled for about 2 hours. And during that session, you'll spend time working homework problems and going through MATLAB and things like that. Last semester, the recitation section was not very well attended, and I think that students' performance suffered because of that. So Tao's going to arrange to email with you what the most convenient time is based on your schedules. But normally it will work out to be Tuesday or Thursday. And it's really important that everybody attend that section and that you actually work, you actually participate and get your problems worked and get your questions answered, because you will have a very hard time in the course if you don't. So Tao will be working on that right away, and hopefully the first class can meet next Tuesday or next week sometime, depending on what date you guys choose. We might consider having more than one of those sections if as we get closer to exams and things, but you'll work with Tao on that, and he's a resource for you. He's also will post his office hours and things, and you should make use of him so that you can be very efficient about how you study and how you learn the material and that. So I hope you'll all get a lot of use out of Tao. He's very smart, very good student, and he's an expert in MATLAB. So with his help, there's no reason you can't learn any material. Other than that, the syllabus was posted online, so please review that carefully. And if you have any questions about that, ask me. The notes will be available. The notes are available online, and we'll work today from the first lecture. A couple of things about the notes. Every lecture will be laid out this way. We'll have the objectives for each lecture on the top. Then we'll have these resource links. These links are I hope you'll find them to be very useful. They explain a lot of the topics that we'll cover in more detail. We'll make use of Wikipedia. Wikipedia has a lot of really nice resources for this class. And I hope you'll spend some time exploring those resources as you go through the lecture notes. And we also will have URLs at the bottom for the lecture and then also for the audio. I will be recording the lectures and posting the audio. We tried that last semester. Students seemed to like it, so we'll continue that. So are there any general questions before we get started? Everyone's excited to be here. We've heard such good things about Signals and Systems. So it's going to be a rough semester, but I've been through this too many times. I think it's just one of those things. We'll get through it. You just have to put in the time. Anybody can learn this material, but it takes time. And time is what you don't have a whole lot of. So it's really important to make use of Tao so that you can be very efficient about how you study. So what I want to talk about today, begin the introductory portion of the class, I want to talk a little bit about the class, what's involved, and then we'll go through some differences between continuous time and discrete time signals and talk a little bit about some properties of the signals. So probably every first lecture you get from every course, they say the same thing. This is the most important course you'll take. But since this is my course, it is the most important course you'll take. Now, this is a really important course. It's a cornerstone of electrical and computer engineering, and it's relevant to most engineering disciplines. In fact, this course is a lot about, as we'll talk in a moment, a lot more than just signal processing. The concepts described in this class, things like Fourier analysis, began in applied mathematics, and they've over time impacted virtually all engineering disciplines. In fact, many non-engineering disciplines, such as business and finance, exploit these concepts today. So we'll talk about a lot of different applications this semester, but one of the ones that I really like talking about is the stock market, because a lot of this kind of technology is actually used to predict and monitor prices on the stock market. And I hope by the end of the semester you'll get a good feel for all the different things we can do with software using the concepts we learn in this course. It's also been interesting to see that tools such as Excel and Photoshop now include extensive signal processing capabilities. I've been in this field for quite a while, so I was involved in a lot of the development of these algorithms. It amazes me when my daughter pulls down software and starts doing all sorts of signal processing stuff on audio and whatnot without even thinking about it. When you know, in Excel has a signal processing, has a lot of signal processing functions. I don't know if you've ever played with those. Photoshop, I always enjoy when students are, you know, doing all this great signal processing with Photoshop and not even thinking, what is that you're doing? Well, what you're doing with those algorithms is exactly what we're going to teach you in this course. So it's a very important topic because many of you have already been very involved in using this technology. And hopefully by the end of the semester, you'll have a much better idea of what you're doing when you use some of these tools. Virtually all engineers use some aspect of the course in their work, since even hardware design begins with computer modeling these days. This is really an introduction to design, simulation, and testing of systems, because what we're going to teach you using tools like MATLAB is how to actually simulate systems on the computer, and that's really where engineering is these days. When I first joined Mississippi State in 94, we used to have a lot of students who would say things like, I don't really like computers. I want to work on circuits. I want to build circuits. I want to be in the lab and things like that. Even if you're a hardware designer today, you may never even actually see the hardware that you design until it's a finished chip. Everything is done with simulation. And oftentimes, people don't understand the limitations of those simulations. So when they design a circuit and it doesn't work, they'll be baffled because they won't understand that circuit doesn't necessarily meet the assumptions of the software that's being used to simulate that circuit. A lot of circuit design these days, especially if you're working on things like microprocessors, you're pushing the edge of the tools that you're dealing with, and you're actually operating outside the parameters for which the simulation is accurate. But you may never know that if you don't understand something about the concepts that we'll talk about in this course. So it's really important to understand what these tools are doing, because most of you will design, just do about all your design in computers. And when you're doing that, you're using a simulation of the circuit. You're not using the actual circuit, obviously. So understanding the difference between the simulation and the real world is a very important thing when you're designing at the edge of your tolerances, whether you're talking about speed or power or some of those things. So this is a course that really teaches you how we can do just about anything we need to in engineering using computer simulation. And that is the way it's done these days. We will focus on basic mathematical concepts such as linearity and some common transformations like the Laplace transform. More advanced courses will deal with how you can combine these concepts and implement these concepts efficiently in hardware. So if you go on to take the DSP course, for example, you'll go through many of the same topics we're talking about today, but you'll learn more about how these are actually implemented in real systems, with real software, and some of the efficiency issues and things like that. Though the analog portion of this course focuses on linear systems, the digital systems that we'll talk about are most often nonlinear in nature due to the ease with which the linearity assumption can be violated in software. So we talk a lot about linear systems in engineering. Undergraduate engineering is in many ways all about linear systems, and we'll learn this semester what a linear system is. And then we'll learn how to implement that system in software. But more often than not, when you implement these systems in software you add things to these systems that make them nonlinear. For example, that MP3 player, which we'll talk about in a moment, is a very nonlinear device because of all the things you can do in software. So as we're plowing through some of these concepts with linear systems, you may not find them very interesting, but it will really become important when we start talking about digital versions of those systems, which are much more, whose properties are much more subtle and difficult to understand. All right, so that was pretty boring. So let's talk about something a little more fun. last semester was the first time I actually started to use one of these devices in class, and I really got a kick out of it. But I don't know what people's favorite devices are. How many people have played with the speech recognition on Google phone? So what are your favorite devices these days? iPhones, or do we have any iPhone fanatics? What?
Yeah, we've got one.
Yeah. So what's hot with that? So my daughter's been teaching me a lot. I've been playing around a lot with audio this past summer, learning about a lot of the technology, and I find a lot of the stuff on the internet really interesting, particularly things like BitTorrent and all this kind of stuff. So one of the things that I like to talk about in the context of this course is an MP3 player. Because for many of you, you go and buy this thing for $30 or whatever and use it and don't think twice about it. Well, I was involved, I was at, my first job was at Texas Instruments in 1983, and I can tell you the days when we didn't think you could even build such devices, but I was very involved in our company at the time, and our group was at the early edges of a lot of this kind of technology. And I remember sitting in meetings where people would say things like, you'll never be able to sell a device with 2 gigabytes of memory for $30. Over the break, I bought a 1 terabyte disk drive for $100. 1 terabyte disk drive. I mean, it's unbelievable what you can do with this stuff. So this little device is all about software, right? The hardware is very simple. It's basically a general purpose computer. And it's all about signal processing and software. So what do you get inside this thing? Well, first of all, it's 1 inches by 2.5 inches. That's pretty amazing in itself. I remember when we first built our first prototype in the mid-80s at Texas Instruments, it was a box about like this. And you could actually fly through Las Vegas. We built it for the Consumer Electronics Show. You could fly through Las Vegas in 3D and stuff. But it was a box like this. And people would look at it and say, well, that's fun and that's interesting, but that's not portable. And now you look at devices like this, which actually, most of this device is really the display. I think you're all familiar with these. The chip itself is probably the size of the tip of my finger. Most of this is just packaging. But it's a small package. It's got a battery which runs for about 13 hours, which is pretty amazing. Since I remember the days when if you wanted 2 gigabytes of memory, you needed a room full of power supplies to keep all that running. It does music, video, photo. It records audio. We're using it right now as an audio recorder. What really amazes me, though, is it's actually got an FM radio in it as well. So you can tune FM stations. You can listen to the stations. You can record. So it's actually a mixed analog-digital device because it's got a radio receiver and the ability then to digitize that radio. And then, of course, it has a USB interface as well. Now, what people conceived of devices like this 50 years ago, but what really has made it possible are advances in integrated circuits and in digital signal processing technology. We had the audio processing algorithms were fairly mature many, many years ago, but it really took about 20 years for the electronics to make this kind of thing feasible. Low power and large inexpensive memories were crucial to the commercial viability of this device. And the signals stored in this device are digital. So this is a digital signal processing device because they consist of discrete time signals whose amplitudes are represented as a finite set of numbers. The signals are compressed to save space using software-based compression, which you all know as MP3. So when you pass around an MP3 file, what's actually in that file? It's digital, but what's the difference between that file, for example, and something like a WAV file?
Compression,
right? So in the MP3 file, in the WAV file, if you use a typical WAV file, you will find samples of the signal. And we'll talk later in the semester about what that means. But the MP3 file is actually a much more sophisticated compression format. And MP3 is a pretty high quality format, but there are a lot of different formats that you compress audio from very high rates down to very low rates with varying degrees of quality. And that kind of thing is one of the major things we'll talk about this semester, is how you represent analog signals digitally and then how you can manipulate them digitally just like you can an analog signal. But this device also has an FM radio and demodulates an electromagnetic wave and converts it to a digital audio signal. So it has the ability to convert an electromagnetic wave to an electrical signal and then to sample and compress that signal. The audio recorder uses a microphone to convert a sound pressure wave into an electrical signal. That's what we're using now. And then it converts that into MP3 signal. Actually, it stores it as wave, and then you can convert it offline as MP3. But it does all this for $30. So when you look at the cost of this device, what is the dominant cost of that device? What?
Software.
Millions of dollars of engineering time goes into the software. The hardware itself is pretty simple. I mean, it's a very complex, it's a very impressive piece of hardware, but it's really just a general purpose computer. I mean, it's got a lot of different peripherals and things. But it's the software that differentiates this. And I can tell you, in fact, that particular model, which is a SANSA software, the first version of the software was terrible. We actually had to go through a software upgrade to get it to work right. But software is where it's really at with these kinds of devices. What's happened with most electronics these days is all of the uniqueness or the differentiation of the product is done in software. And that software is what you learn about more or less in this class. Now, we learn mostly here about algorithms and about the signal processing concepts and don't talk about how you implement those things in software. Instead, we use MATLAB to implement these things in software. Now, MATLAB is a really nice tool because it allows you to do a lot of things very easily. For example, if you want to compute a Fourier transform, you just call a function FFT and it does it. Unfortunately, in doing that, you don't learn a lot about the details. We'll focus more on the mathematical properties of these algorithms. But if you want to learn about the details, then you can go into a more advanced class like the DSP class. So we'll, throughout the semester, come back to this device because it's a good example of many of the things we can do in signals and systems. So, examples of signals. Electrical signals. Many of you are familiar with that. You've been learning about analog electrical signals now for a while. These are things like voltages and currents in a circuit. Acoustic signals. These are things like audio or speech signals. When I speak to you, when I lecture, the signal that's leaving my lips is a sound pressure wave. The pressure is being modulated as a function of time. And when you hear, the way you hear that signal, your ear takes that signal and vibrates essentially through the mechanics of your ear and converts that into an electrical signal, a neurological signal, which then flows into your brain and you magically decode. So you actually are an analog to digital or analog to electrical converter because you're converting my sound pressure wave into an electrical signal. Video signals, and these typically involve color or intensity variations as a function of both space and time. Video signals are really interesting, and we'll talk a little bit more about those. Biological signals, this is a very fairly newer area of signal processing. A lot of the techniques we've used for modeling things like audio and video signals are now being used to try to understand sequences in DNA and to represent DNA sequences as a sort of a sum of some component signals. So this is a fairly new and pretty exciting area. It goes by various names, bioinformatics and things, but it involves a lot of the same concepts that we've been using in other signal processing applications for some time. Now the internet has introduced many new forms of signals as multimedia documents. So when you watch a CNN broadcast on the internet, you know, think about all the different kinds of signals that go into that. You've got audio, you've got video, you've got computer generated imagery, you've got sometimes still you've got videos of browsers of the internet. I mean, there's a lot of different kinds of signals that go into that. And then you as a user would like to be able to search all this information. You'd like to be able to do a search and have it find not just text information, but also relevant audio, relevant video. And to do all that, we need the kinds of algorithms that we'll talk about in this course, because you have to have a way of converting speech signals to text if you want to search them. You have to have a way of converting video images to some kind of textual description if you want to search them and decide if the information is relevant. So we won't talk too much about those kinds of signals in this class, but those signals really push the limits of our ability to model signals mathematically. And then on top of all this, you have noise. Noise is defined really as unwanted components in your signal that are often random. When you talk over your cell phones pick up a lot of the ambient noise, and that noise causes a lot of problems for the algorithms. And we'll talk a little bit this semester about how you characterize noise and how you deal with it. But it's an important thing to think about, because if you've ever noticed, when you're talking on your cell phone and other people start talking in the background, it becomes much harder to understand the voice, because the algorithms that are used in cell phones are model one person's voice. They're not really designed to model multiple people's voices simultaneously. So if you ever have to tell someone, "I can't understand you, can you go to a more quiet place?" That's because sometimes it's picking up other people's voices, and that's causing the algorithm to perform very poorly. So video signals are interesting because they're discrete in several dimensions. I think this is a link here, if I remember right. But I don't have my mouse for some reason. Which could be a problem. So I think this was... I did this last semester when Usain Bolt won the 100-meter dash. It was really amazing. And I guess we don't have audio here. But when you think about, when you look at this image in terms of a signal, what are you seeing here? What are the dimensions of this signal? Now, normally when we think about an audio signal, for example, we think of the amplitude of the audio as a function of time. Well, video signals are much more complicated, because you have, what are some of the dimensions associated with the signal? If you had to describe a video signal, what are some of the components of this video signal?
Pixels.
We have pixels, which we often will call space. And how many, in what directions or dimensions do we have pixels? We've got two dimensions, right? So we've got an X and a Y. And what, and add a pixel, what kind of information do we have?
Color.
And color can often be coded as an RGB. So we've got three 8-bit values, space, X and Y, and what else?
Intensity.
Well, that's sort of color. There's another important dimension to this signal. That makes it a move. The what?
How long it stays up there? If it's a video,
time,
you gotta change.
Time, right? It's changing as a function of time. Now, is it a continuous signal as a function of time? Or is it discrete? It's discrete. Why? Are they true? How do you know this is a discrete signal?
It's frames per second.
It's transmitting either 30 or 60 frames per second. So it's actually, if you think of the frames as kind of planes, it's transmitting these in a discrete time. Now, why does it appear to you as a continuous image?
Your eye integrates.
Your eye integrates over time, and you don't really notice that it's a discrete image. So this is a very complicated signal. On top of that, when we transmit this signal, at least in the old days, we're about to go through a completely revolution in transmission of video signals, but in the old days, this was modulated in a certain way to be transmitted over a certain frequency bandwidth. And that modulation process was actually fairly complicated for video signals to preserve the quality and compress it to a certain bandwidth. What's about to happen on February 17th? We're going digital. So what does that mean? The signal's already digital.
From America died.
Actually, I'm excited. I'm finally getting more stations at my house, and I live out in the country here, and we just installed our converter box over the break, and I pick up one extra channel. But this is amazing. But what's the signal's already digital, so what do we mean digital transmission?
You don't convert to analog to send it over the airwaves.
It's actually sent as a digital signal. So on top of the way the signal's represented, there's also the way the signal's modulated and transmitted. And we'll talk a little bit about that today, this semester. And then if you want to study more of that, you go into the communications course. But then on top of all of that, we don't just send the raw signal. Why?
It's too big.
Too big. It's normally, digitally, that's about a couple gigabytes per second of information. We compress it down to about 30 megabits per second or 2 megabits, you know, somewhere in that range. So on top of all that, we do audio and video compression using software, using the types of concepts that we'll talk about in this course. So there's a very nice example of how important all the things we'll learn in this course are. So we're going to now start to build up a vocabulary of how we talk about or how we represent signals. And one of the first concepts that we will introduce is the notion of an independent variable. Time is often the independent variable for a signal. So we'll write, and now don't freak out, we're going to get into math notation. And I know people, you know, I know mathematically students tend to struggle. We'll just work through that step by step. So today, we're going to introduce the concept x of t. That's just a signal whose amplitude is a function of time. X of t is used to represent a signal that is a function of time. I've drawn a signal here to the right. This is an ECG signal. It's got a voltage as a function of time. A temporal signal is defined by the relationship of its amplitude, the dependent variable, to time, the independent variable. So the independent variable is time, because that can you can essentially pick any value of time you want. And the dependent variable is amplitude, because when you plug in a value of the independent variable t, this function returns a value of the signal. So I like to call this a gumball machine. You put your penny in and out comes a gumball. The function x of t defines amplitude as a function of time. Now, an independent variable can be one-dimensional time. It can be two-dimensional space. It can be three-dimensional space, or even something more complicated. For example, the internet is changing a lot of the way we look at signals. When I want to build a function that describes your browsing history, what is a dependent variable? Is it time? Is it space? Well, not quite. It's more like events. Every time you click on a link, that becomes an event. So we actually use things other than these for independent variables, but for the most of this course, we'll talk about time in one dimension as being the independent variable. And then the signal is described as a function of this variable. There are many types of functions that can be used to describe signals. We'll talk about continuous, discrete. We'll actually talk about random as well a little bit this semester, because a lot of what we're doing in signal processing today is modeling signals as random events and using statistics. So those are the three primary things we'll look at this semester. So let's talk a little bit more about continuous time signals. Most of the signals in the physical world are continuous time signals. Since the time scale is infinitesimally fine, this means things like voltage, pressure, temperature, and velocity. Now, the interesting thing about signals is we never really get to look at, with continuous time signals like this, physical signals, we never actually get to look at the real signal itself. We're always looking at the signal through what's called a transducer, through some device that converts the signal to an electrical signal. And that's why electrical engineers get paid the large salaries that they do, because just about everything gets converted to an electrical signal if you want to do something with it. If you think about all the different devices we build and deal with, they all essentially convert real-world signals in some way to electrical signals. So, for example, In nature, we have a lot of interesting transducers. We have your ears, which convert, as we discussed, convert sound pressure waves. In fact, the human body, you can think about it, is really just a lot of different transducers. And we have the ears. We have your eyes, which convert light signals into electrical signals that also flow into your brain. Those two have been fairly well studied over the years. And one that's been much less studied but is growing recently in significance is the nose. Your nose actually converts smell, you know, smell converts, chemicals into some kind of electrical stimulation. And in the past, there hasn't been a lot of work done on that, but now you're seeing people actually developing things like electronic noses, circuits that can actually smell. And that's a very hot area, both because of, you want to build devices that can sense toxic gases and things like that, or you'd like to build devices that can sense bomb material, explosive materials and things like that. And these, as transducers, are pretty complicated. We've tried over the years to build circuits that simulate the ear, the eyes, the nose, and it's been very hard because the human body has a lot of very sophisticated capability to it. And these sensors in the human body actually interact with your brain. Your ear receives feedback from the brain and actually adjusts itself based on the signal. And that's a little bit hard to deal with. So simpler transducers are things like voltmeters, microphones, and pressure sensors. And you may have already worked with circuits that do these kinds of things. But it's important to remember that these devices only approximate the physical signal. And therefore, they introduce some amount of distortion between the actual signal and the signal you're seeing in your as an electrical signal and the signal you're seeing on the computer. And we'll discuss some of that process this semester. So here we have a continuous time signal, x of t, as a function of time. And we'll, you know, make use of these kinds of plots quite frequently throughout the semester. Now, in contrast, we have discrete time signals, and that we'll spend about half the semester on discrete time signals. We can write a collection of numbers, for example, 1, minus 3, 7, and 9, representing a signal as a function of a discrete variable n. And we're going to write these as x with two brackets of n. And this represents amplitude or value as a function of n. And so this a discrete time signal has a continuous valued amplitude. This value can be anything you like, but it's discrete in time. Now that is not what is stored on your computer, and I'll talk to that in a moment, because your computer can't handle the continuous valued amplitude. But discrete time signals are very useful for mathematically analyzing systems. So we'll use them a lot this semester, but really, that's not exactly what we'll see when we're writing computer software. Many human-generated signals are discrete. For example, we have things like MIDI codes, stock market prices, and some digital images. These are signals which are actually created as discrete signals. They don't have an analog counterpart. And that's another interesting thing about a lot of the internet and a lot of the new technology that's come online. When you talk about music created from MIDI codes, the MIDI codes are the source format, and that's actually a discrete representation. So in this course, we will show that most of the properties that apply to continuous time signals apply in a similar manner to discrete time signals. One of my goals in this course is to make you perfectly comfortable processing digital signals and continuous time signals. There's no real difference between the two once you get past a little bit of mathematics. So we'll teach you the Fourier transform for continuous time signals, and then we'll also teach you the Fourier transform for discrete time signals. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about symmetry. Symmetry is a very important part of engineering, and signals that are symmetric have very nice mathematical properties. And we actually use a lot of symmetric signals in our kind of daily life. So we're going to introduce the concept of a continuous time periodic signal. So we can write this mathematically as x of t is equal to x of t plus capital T, where capital T is the period. So we show a picture here of x of t, and you can see that it is repeats itself essentially every capital T seconds. So this is a very simple concept, but it's one that's very important to a lot of what we will do in signal processing. Now you'll notice that because the signal repeats with time t, it also repeats with time 2t and 4t and so forth. So t is actually the smallest value for which the signal is periodic. Now we can introduce a similar concept for discrete time signals. We can write that x of n, and that actually I noticed should, those should be square brackets, but x of n is equal to x of n plus capital N. And that same thing holds true. The signal repeats itself every capital N samples. Now, periodicity with discrete time signals is a little more subtle because we have this problem that the period may not be an exact multiple of the number of samples. And that actually is a very real issue when you deal with high quality music and things like that. But we won't worry about that for the moment. We'll just define a periodic discrete time signal as being a signal which repeats every capital N samples. Now there is a sort of a subtlety here that the sum of two continuous time signals is periodic only if the ratio of their periods can be written as the ratio of two integers. We will exploit this fact when building signals out of sums of periodic signals, and we'll come to know that as a Fourier series. We won't dwell on this right now, but not all, if you sum two periodic signals, you do not necessarily get a periodic signal. That's an interesting mathematical property, and we'll talk about that a little bit later when we need to. What are some examples of common periodic signals that we deal with every day?
Trigonometric functions, sine, cosine, all.
Yeah, what about this stuff that powers, that comes out of the wall here? What is that?
60-hertz sine wave.
60-hertz sine wave, right. Isn't it a cosine wave?
Yes, it depends on when you start feeding the zero.
Very good. So we'll have to talk about phase, but we'll use the term sine wave to mean essentially a sinusoidal signal, and we'll talk later about phase. So symmetry, we can actually have some additional symmetric properties. A very important property in signal processing is what's known as even and odd property. So in the first graphic, we have a continuous time signal that's even. And what this means is that when x, we can write this mathematically as x of t is equal to x of minus t. What that means graphically is that the signal for the positive portion of the x-axis has to be equal to the signal for the negative x-axis, so sort of reflected. So you see that, not a pointer here, but you see that a value, essentially we have this portion of the signal reflected. So a signal being even, we write as x of t is equal to x of minus t, and we have a discrete time counterpart of that, that x of n is equal to x of minus n. A signal that is odd has a similar property, but instead of being equal to x of t, it's equal to minus x of t. Now, you'll recognize this pretty quickly as what type of signal that you're familiar with has this kind of a structure to it? Sine wave. And what kind of a signal has that type of structure? Cosine wave, right? So cosines are even signals, sines are odd signals. But the property is more general than just cosines or sines. And these properties are important because the transforms of these signals will be relatively simple to compute. We can make use of these symmetry properties. And we'll actually build other signals out of these even and odd signals. So let's talk a little bit about properties. Any signal, Any signal can be expressed as a sum of even and odd signals, and what that means is that we can take a function x of t and we can write it as the sum of an even part and an odd part, and then those even parts we can actually form as x of t plus x of minus t over 2, and the odd part we can form as x of t minus x of minus t over 2. So this is demonstrated here on the right. We have a discrete time signal, and we create the even part of that signal by taking that signal and adding it to x of minus t version of that signal, and then we create the odd part, and then the sum of these two signals will give you back the original signal. Now, it's a little, I don't expect you to fully grasp this today, but I'm just demonstrating that even and odd signals are important because all signals can be represented in terms of even and odd signals. And computing the transforms and manipulating even and odd signals is easier than a signal which is neither even or odd. So there are times when we will decompose signals into even and odd signals. The compression algorithms that work in this MP3 player actually make use of these kinds of properties to get the bit rate of the signal down. So these are actually used in real algorithms, and we'll see later in the semester a little bit about how that's done. Now, there's other types of symmetry that we will talk about this semester. A right-sided signal is considered a signal which is zero for some time less than capital T. So we draw a picture of that on the left. And typically, we'll talk about right-sided signals that begin at time equals zero. That will be very important when we talk about Laplace transforms. We'll make use of that fact. Left-sided signal is just the mirror of that. So left-sided signal is zero for t greater than some time capital T. And left-sided and right-sided signals have particular properties associated with them that we will exploit when we talk about things like Laplace transforms or Z-transforms. Z-transforms, we'll see, are used for discrete time signals. A signal can be bounded or unbounded depending on the stability of the system. Stability is a concept we'll discuss extensively this semester. It's a very important concept to engineering. And a signal that is the output of an unstable system is generally unbounded. So here we have a just showing some examples of a bounded signal. A decaying exponential is a bounded signal. An unbounded signal would be an exponential with a positive exponent. And here we have versions of that for left-sided signals as well. We'll also talk about causality a bit this semester, but we won't do too much of that today. Now, thus far we've talked about real valued signals, that is signals whose amplitude is a real number. But we also use complex signals, particularly in areas like communications. In general, X can be a complex quantity that has a real and imaginary part. You've dealt with complex numbers when you've done circuit analysis. Complex quantities are very useful when we do signals and systems type analysis, particularly with circuits. So we'll make a lot of use of these. So, and it's really nothing magical about these. These are just a function x of t where the value produced is a complex number. So it has a real and imaginary part, or equivalently a magnitude and a phase angle. A very important class of signals is the class called a complex exponential. And for continuous time signals, this has the form e to the st, where s is a complex number. That's actually the basis of a Laplace transform. And for discrete time signals, it has the form z to the power n, where z is a complex number. And that's the basis of what we call a z transform. So, for example, suppose s is equal to j pi over 8, and z is equal to e to the j pi over 8. We can write that e to the st is going to be e to the j pi t over 8, showing that here. And the real part of this signal, e to the jx, this is a concept we're going to make use of extensively this semester, e to the jx
is just cosine x plus j sine x, right? So the real part of this e to the j pi t over 8 is cosine pi t over 8. So there we have a picture of the real part of this signal. The real part of z to the n is also cosine pi n over 8. So we're going to use this extensively to represent signals, and we'll often take a look at the real and imaginary parts of the signals. You've done a little bit of that with your circuit analysis. And we can build a lot of different signals out of this complex exponentials. They really form the basis for what we know as traditional signal processing, because you can represent a lot of different signals with a complex signal. So suppose, for example, S, this complex variable, is sigma plus j omega for a continuous time signal. Then we can write that x of t is e to the st, x of t is e to the sigma plus j omega t. Now that's kind of an interesting signal. That's a complex signal which is the product of this function. Has two parts to it, e to the sigma t and e to the j omega t. Right? We can write that. Now, what happens to this part if sigma is positive?
It increases, it's going to grow.
It increases, right? It's going to grow exponentially, which is a bad thing if that's a signal, right? If you build an oscillator that doesn't mean quite stable in the lab, you see the thing pin your meter and such. And so if this is positive, this thing grows, and we show that over here with sigma greater than zero. What about sigma less than zero? Well, it decays. That's a nicer thing. Now, what about this e to the j omega t? You can impress me today. One of the questions students always have trouble with for some reason is that. What is the magnitude of e to the j omega t? Here's your chance to impress me.
One.
Why? It's a good chance. It's 0, 1, those are good guesses, right? How would you draw this? How would you draw this? You had to explain to my 5-year-old daughter, she's no longer 5 years old though, what that is. How would you draw this?
Basically like this.
And I find it interesting because you've been using this with phasor analysis for circuits. But you haven't quite connected all the pieces yet. This is a vector of magnitude 1, which one way to think about it is it rotates with the frequency omega. Another way to think about it is this omega t term here represents the angle. So we're going to make use of these kinds of complex exponentials a lot in this class because they're really convenient for representing a broad class of signals. We can build most of the signals that you've been dealing with out of these, and we can also study the properties of the system by looking at stability in terms of these exponential terms and such. So what we've done today is to introduce some simple concepts of signals. We've talked about continuous and discrete. We've talked about time varying, spatially varying. We've talked about one-dimensional signals, multi-dimensional signals. And what we'll do in this course is we'll introduce tools that work for all of these signals. So we'll talk about Fourier transforms for signals, for one-dimensional signals, two-dimensional signals, and so forth. And we'll focus mostly on one-dimensional signals this semester, but most of the things you learn will be applicable to multi-dimensional signals. And then we talked a little bit about symmetry. The more symmetry a signal has, the easier it is to represent, the more you can compress it. And players like these MP3 players exploit that. So understanding the underlying properties of signals and systems would be very important, and that's really what this course is about. So I hope you'll, in the future, it'd be nice if you could skim the textbook before you come to class so you have some idea of what we're going to talk about, and if you can maybe look through the lecture notes as well. But next class we'll pick this up and talk about properties of systems.
Yesterday when I checked the lectures, lecture minutes and all that,
I noticed that. I don't know what happened there. Because I had checked it and I posted it, and I couldn't do it before class, yeah. And in the future, just email me, and I'll probably be online to fix it.